It's 5:06, and you're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Veronica Rickard.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up later in the show, we'll look at the rise of locally sourced lunches at Wisconsin schools.
But first, according to our next guest, birth by cesarean section has reached epidemic proportions in the United States.
The 2011 numbers put the rate at about 33%. That's an increase of 50% over the last decade.
Joining us now to help sort out what's happening and why is Teresa Morris. She's a professor of sociology at Trinity College and the author of Cut It Out, The C-Section Epidemic in America. Teresa, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you for having me. I'm delighted to join you, Veronica.
Well, you start your book by sharing the story of the first time you gave birth and how things went quite a bit differently than you'd planned. Could you tell us a little bit about your own story?
Sure. My son was a surprise breech baby, and that is that we expected he was in a head-down position, but when I went to the hospital in labor, it turned out he was actually head up and had his feet up by his ears. That's called a frank breech position. And so I was whisked away for a swift C-section, and that really bothered me in a lot of ways. I'd done a lot of preparation and had hoped to have a vaginal birth. I think most women, the data shows, hope to have a vaginal birth. And that really, changed the way I thought about birth, I think, because of that surprise. So when I became pregnant a few years later, I really wanted to have a vaginal birth, and I did the research because women, of course, after having a C-section could have a repeat C-section or could have what's called a vaginal birth after cesarean section, which is often referred to as a VBAC because of the acronym. And what I found was that it's difficult to find a supportive provider and to stay free of interventions in the hospital if one chooses to do that. And I actually did have a successful VBAC birth at a hospital in Connecticut, and I thought that was a really empowering experience. What I was really left with, however, was the feeling that it really is very difficult for women to find, again, supportive care. And I'm an organizational sociologist, so having a background in studying banks and corporations, I decided to change my lens to studying birth and how maybe organizations might have some responsibility in the high C-section rate.
Well, it's interesting because before I read your book and I knew a little bit about it, I assumed that the reason would be that women were electing themselves to have C-sections, and you call this the too posh to push sort of argument about why more C-sections are happening, but it turns out maybe that's not the case. Do you want to talk about that assumption and what you found?
Sure. I think that's a common explanation for the C-section rate, and there's actually evidence that shows that although most providers have very few women who ask for a primary C-section rate, or I should say an elective cesarean for no medical indication, even if they have few women who do that, they often believe that that's a high cause of the C-section rate, so it's kind of interesting. The empirical evidence suggests that less than 1% of women ask for a C-section with no medical indication. And this is often hard to tease out because most researchers use birth certificate data to understand why a woman had a C-section. And even if it might indicate that a woman had a C-section for no medical indication, it's really difficult on a birth certificate then to figure out if that was a woman's request or if a physician suggested that to her. But all the survey as evidence suggests that women very seldom ask for a C-section without medical indication.
Well, it would be interesting, if that were the reason, because I think to the general public, in most cases, you think that a C-section, it can be done under extreme conditions, of course, to save a mother's life or a baby's life. But by and large, I think that we think of C-sections as being pretty routine and pretty safe. Is that true?
I think that's a very, very common, and the college students I teach in a course on reproduction have said that to me. Oh, we thought that C-sections were just really safe. And I don't want to suggest that women who have C-sections should think of them as inherently unsafe, because I think in modern medicine they're relatively safe. But I think when you look at a comparison of C-sections compared to vaginal birth, that we see that they're more dangerous for women and babies, and that is that both women and babies are more likely to be injured or to die in a cesarean section birth than in a vaginal birth. And I think that's the comparison we need to focus on.
Well, you're talking about how there are higher rates of injury, maybe death sometimes, and yet here we are at this high rate, 33% in the United States. Could you put that into context a little for us? How high is that really? Is 33% something to be alarmed at?
I think it's very alarming. The best benchmark we have is from the World Health Organization, which has for almost 30 years suggested that countries that have a C-section rate over 15% put women's lives and health at risk. And we know that that's the case. And with the U.S. C-section rate being twice that, we know that then women and I should say babies too are being unnecessarily harmed with that high rate. I should say also that the maternal mortality rate in the United States, so that would be the rate of women who give birth and die within 40 days, that's actually increasing, and that should be a really big concern, and I think it is a big concern in the public health world, and that rate has increased 75% in the last 20 years. So it is at epidemic levels. And one other point I would make that C-sections are sometimes necessary, as you mentioned, and can save lives, and the World Health Organization suggests that countries that have a C-section rate below 5% put women's lives and at risk. So it's that hitting that middle, point between 5 and 15 seems to be what's best for countries. And we're significantly higher than that.
Okay, so we found out that it's not women who are electing to have them because, you know, they just don't want to go through the ordeal of having a baby.
Right.
So what is causing the trend of C-sections?
Right. Well, I think that what has happened is that due to some congressional changes about how hospitals and providers would be compensated for providing care to patients, and that happened in the 1980s. I think since the 1980s, the healthcare industry has been put under increasing profit pressures, and that continues today. And that's why we see the growth of the size of practices. That's why we see increasing growth of hospital systems. That's something that hospitals really can't control. And so what they've turned to controlling are liability risks, and that is that any time a physician takes care of a patient, and a hospital is also responsible for this, if there's a bad outcome, that could be due to medical negligence. And if it is medical negligence, then providers are held responsible for that, and hospitals are held responsible for that. And so malpractice insurance is routinely used then by both providers and hospitals to pay for any of those types of events that happen. But what's happened then because of these cost pressures, I think, is that hospitals and providers then have put in place practices in hospitals that deal with birth that aren't evidence-based to improve outcomes, but rather are used to protect hospitals and providers from liability.
Like what?
In the case of a bad outcome. Well, I think the best example is the protocol for the use of a continuous electronic fetal monitor, and that would be used continuously during labor to monitor a baby's heart rate. Now, there's no evidence that a woman wearing a continuous fetal monitor improves fetal outcomes compared to a woman who is just monitored, it's called intermittently, every 30 minutes during active labor, every 5 minutes when the woman is pushing. But what has been shown is that women are much more likely to have a C-section if they wear an electronic fetal monitor. So for every 6 women, low-risk women who have an electronic fetal monitor worn continuously, one of those women will have a C-section because of an issue with the monitor showing fetal distress. The monitor has a 99.8% false positive rate. You might ask why it's still used.
Right. That is the question.
Right. It's used because providers and hospitals have learned that if there is a bad baby outcome, that they will be asked to show evidence that the baby was being properly monitored and to show that that baby was doing fine and a cesarean section was not necessary, or it was not necessary earlier if the baby was born by C-section. So they've learned through courts and through media that they have to have that, and they just won't abandon it, even though there's no evidence. And I talked to a physician today who told me that, you know, it would never be abandoned also because it allows nurses to watch more than one patient at a time, and hospitals just can't afford to hire enough nurses.
What about in other countries? What do they do, other developed nations that have lower rates than this 33 where we are? What do they do differently?
I have to say that I'm not an expert on other countries. Other countries tend to have lower rates than we do, but I have to say that that's not something I've explored, why they're lower than the United States.
What else do hospitals do that you think could, you know, that they currently is something that's a common practice that could reduce the C-section rate?
Things that they do that could reduce the
C-section rate? If they stop doing it, right.
They could stop doing it.
Right.
Yeah. Well, beyond the electronic fetal monitor, many women have their labors artificially started or induced rather than going into spontaneous labor. Those women the current induction rate is 41% in the United States, and those women are twice as likely to have a C-section than women whose labors start naturally. And that's particularly the case for first-time moms whose uterus just really isn't ready to go into labor yet, and there are signs for that, those women have about a 50% chance of a C-section. Now, a lot of these inductions happen because women are what is considered overdue. They haven't delivered by their due date, which is considered 41 weeks gestation. That would be a quick pregnancy.
Nice, huh?
So women are often induced, so they won't go past 40 weeks because there is some evidence that delivering past 41 weeks increases a woman's chance of stillbirth, although the risk is so tiny you can't quantify it. So it doesn't happen very often. But providers are worried that if a woman delivers after 40 or 41 weeks, they may use different guidelines there, that they'll be held liable or they'll be held accountable for that. So they induce these women, and just inducing them increases their chance of C-section. And one other thing I'll just mention is the use of ultrasound in late pregnancy. Ultrasound, of course, uses sound waves to visualize the fetus. And when women have an ultrasound in the last month of pregnancy, that increases their risk of having a C-section by about 40%. And that's a lot because this visualization of the fetus allows a provider to worry that the fetus is big and won't fit well or will somehow have a problem. One typical problem would be shoulder dystocia. That's when a baby's head is born vaginally and the shoulders get stuck. It's more common with big babies over 9 pounds, 15 ounces, but it can happen in any birth. But if a provider suspects a baby is big based on ultrasound prediction, then that baby might be delivered prophylactically by C-section, or the provider may intervene more quickly thinking that the baby is going to be big and get stuck.
We're talking right now with Teresa Morris. She's the author of Cut It Out, The C-Section Epidemic in America. And we'll be back with her in just a bit.
And we want to hear your stories and your questions. Why do you think C-sections are increasing dramatically in the United States? Is it a problem or just an instance of preventive medicine? Call us at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or you can post on our Central Time Facebook page. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network.
We're talking with Teresa Morris about the dramatic increase in births by C-sections in the U.S. The 2011 rate puts us at 33%. It's one of the highest in the developed world.
We want to hear from you. Why do you think C-sections are on the rise? Are you worried about it? What was your experience? Call us at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or send an email, talk@WPR.org.
Let's go to the phones now. We have Jessica joining us from Ladysmith. Hi, Jessica.
Hi. I currently work in a hospital, and I just recently found this out after I've had 3 children, and I had a C-section with my 3rd, that if you have a C-section, depending on the insurance held by the hospital, your additional children may have to be delivered C-section in order for you to have your children there.
Interesting. What do you know about that, Teresa?
I guess I didn't understand the question that you have to have a C-section to have your child at the same hospital.
That's what it sounded like. Let's see if Jessica's still there. Do we have that right, Jessica?
In some smaller hospitals, because of the insurance that they carry, the insurance to the hospital.
Oh, okay. The malpractice insurance. Yeah. So yes, depending on the hospital, right now, there are documented to be 30% of hospitals in the United States ban vaginal birth after cesarean section attempts. So if you're at a hospital that bans that, then you would be told that you had to have a C-section. Now, the American College of Obstetricians and Gynecologists suggests in their most recent practice bulletin on vaginal birth after cesarean section, which was in 2010, that women who desire to have a vaginal birth after a C-section and have a provider or want to deliver at a hospital that won't allow that should be referred somewhere else. Of course, we all know that's not always possible, particularly if women live a long ways from another hospital. But I think that is common.
Okay, thank you for the call, Jessica. And we move now to Andrea in La Crosse. Hi, Andrea.
Hi, yes. I was just going to say I'm a mother of 3, and with each of my children, I really went out of my way to find providers that didn't use the fetal monitoring that would allow me to labor naturally. And it wasn't always easy to do, but I felt really strongly about it because I feel like interventions like the monitoring, like these C-sections, they just lead to so many other complications that's really detrimental, and people using them in these massive quantities is only hurting us.
And were
you know, the mothers and children that have this very special experience, it takes that away. in a lot of cases, I'm not saying that all C-sections, you know, do that, but when it's unnecessary, it does.
And Andrea, were you able to find hospitals and providers that would let you labor the way that you wanted to labor?
You know, I had great luck here in Wisconsin finding that. My second son was born in South Dakota, and it was very difficult to find providers there. Very difficult. We also had one in Utah, and it was easier there. But I've been impressed with the hospitals, especially in La Crosse, here where I live, and their willingness to work with me and the access to midwives. And, yeah, it's been a good experience here. I'm glad that we moved here.
All right. Thank you, Andrea. I appreciate the call. And, Teresa, you know, one thing, you know, the woman, it seems like you needed to do this was to be an advocate for the way that you wanted to labor. Another thing that you mentioned is doulas. How do you feel about doulas?
Yeah, doulas are labor assistants who help women in birth really kind of labor in the way that she would want to. And all evidence suggests that having one-on-one support, and that could be with a doula or someone else, but a lot of literature focuses on doulas, decreases a woman's chance of C-section, reduces her labor time, and is really seen as a benefit. So I'm a really big supporter of doulas.
All right, well, let's go back to the phones. Patrick is joining us now in West Bend. Hey, Patrick.
Hi, I just wanted to share my experience. My wife and I, for our first child, had intended to have a natural childbirth. And we went to natural child birth classes and all of that. But because of some health issues, you know, we wound up needing to have a medical intervention, and which eventually led to a C-section. And after all that experience, I was kind of surprised to learn that you my wife would rather have just had the C-section, you know, not gone through. You know, we tried induction, and it was a really a long and grueling ordeal and very scary for her at the end. And, you know, it. I think we had this kind of, I don't want to say prejudice, but just this idea that we wanted to have, you know, the most natural experience possible. We wanted to avoid a C-section. And I think in the end, we just sort of had this guilt about how it wound up that it seemed kind of unnecessary. It just seems like this, in the face of, you know, real health problems and health risks that, you know, maybe the importance of a natural childbirth is, you know, not that significant.
Great, Patrick. Thank you for the call. I'm glad you brought that up because, you know, sometimes it does seem as though there's pressure on women and families to have a perfectly natural birth. You know, I've heard of people lying about the way that they delivered so that they didn't have to admit that they had a C-section. Is there a middle ground here where we can be accepting of C-sections and also, you know, maybe encouraging when we can of a vaginal birth?
Oh, I absolutely agree with you, Veronica. I think that that particularly when women have had a difficult birth experience, and it sounds like from what Patrick describes, it might have been difficult for his wife. He mentioned induction and some health issues. Oftentimes, those women, for example, if they go on to have another birth, choose not to have another vaginal birth and say they would just rather have a C-section. And I think we have to respect that, and we have to respect that not all babies can be born safely with a C-section. You know, and that was the point why I made the points about the World Health Organization saying that countries with a C-section rate under 5% also put women's health at risk. And I do think that we should respect, you know, all different types of birth and respect that women may make different choices based on an experience or a medical condition and about what she'll tolerate best.
Well, in the last minute or so here, what would you recommend we do to lower the number of C-sections? You know, you look at hospitals and the way they run as an organization. Mm-hmm. What things can hospitals do and what things can women themselves do?
Right. I think that women can do things, you know, like your one of the callers described, I believe it was Andrea, about seeking out providers who have low intervention, low C-section rates, seeking out hospitals that have low C-section rates. And there are some resources to do that. One is cesareanrates.com. And consumer advocate Jill Arnold has collected hospital-level data for most states on C-section rates. And I think women can also take independent childbirth classes and learn about different risks and benefits of interventions and make decisions about what they would like that birth to be like. And so I think for women, it's that information. I think hospitals should really examine the protocols they're using, and that ties to the American College of Obstetricians and Gynecologists. That's where a lot of the protocols come from. And really, you know, I think hospitals and providers have to insist on evidence-based protocols and practices. And the ACOG, there was an article that came out a few years ago that suggested that ACOG policy, practice bulletins, fewer than 30% are based on good and consistent scientific evidence. And so I think that's a problem that needs to be addressed, and that's something that hospitals and providers can do. I also think at a more societal level, we just have to think about malpractice reform, maybe a no-fault system. That allows babies to receive care regardless of if there was negligence or not.
All right. Teresa, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you so much. I enjoyed it.
That was Teresa Morris. She's the author of Cut It Out, The C-Section Epidemic in America.
Coming up on Central Time, we'll hear about the rise of farm-to-table school lunches in Wisconsin. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network.
It's Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickard.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up on Central Time, we'll be talking with conservationist Terry Tempest Williams. She's in Wisconsin, and she says environmental issues are social issues, too.
First, a new report out today from the U.S. Department of Agriculture details the extent of farm-to-school programs in the United States.
And according to the report, more than half of Wisconsin's public school districts are buying food from local sources. Another fifth are planning to.
Here to talk with us about what these programs do and getting kids connected with their food is Miriam Grunes. She is executive director of the REAP Food Group. Miriam, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me, Veronica.
Well, more than half of Wisconsin's public school districts are buying food from local sources, according to the census. What's your reaction to that?
Well, we were so excited to see the USDA census come out with those kinds of numbers in Wisconsin. We've been working here in the Madison area on farm-to-school work for about a decade, and it's a long and slow process, but it's just really clear that things are starting to change for school food.
Now, when we're talking about buying from local sources, I'm assuming this doesn't mean the whole lunch is entirely comprised of local ingredients, but there are components of it that are local.
Yeah, that's absolutely the case. I mean, we're just, you know, a little bit down the path of this kind of transformation in our schools, and we're still pretty dependent on the highly processed food and school meal program, unfortunately. But, you know, slowly the shift is happening, and it's, you know, to the benefit of the kids and their health, but also to our local farm economy and really making it possible for local farmers to have some real economic gain by feeding healthy food to kids right at school.
What might a lunch look like now with some of these local ingredients?
You know, it's really variable around the state how much different school districts are doing. Some of the smaller districts are certainly doing really innovative things and starting to buy even local meats. I would say for the most part, the biggest item that schools are finding the way to buy locally are things like apples and other fruits, starting to get into produce a little bit more. But again, it's just small steps for now.
Now, are schools going organic too, or is the emphasis more on just buying local?
Surprisingly more organic than we would have thought, but really just local and fresh. Schools, especially in the last couple of years when the USDA changed some of the nutrition guidelines for schools, there's really been an emphasis on feeding kids more fresh fruits and vegetables, and that opened a door for local farm products to be part of that mix.
Well, someone who advocates for this, why do you think it is important to get these locally sourced foods into school lunches?
Oh, gosh, where should we start? certainly, the obesity epidemic and the health ramifications of how our kids are being fed is really important as we move forward. Schools can be this place that's the great equalizer that all children, regardless of their backgrounds and what's happening in their homes and other parts of their lives, can be this place where healthy food can be a part of things. But from our perspective, it's just as important for the local farm economy, for making sure healthy food will be there for all of us in the future. We got to make sure our farmers are taken care of, and that's a really big part of the puzzle.
Yeah, it was interesting. There was a statistic that came out of the census that of a budget of $32 million going towards school food, I think it was $4.3 million stayed within the community.
Yeah, I'm really curious to see how those numbers came to be. We saw that too. it's part of that may be what people are calling local and how that's all being added up. But I'm really curious to see how those numbers came to be.
Is that a decent number by your estimate?
Yeah, it's a fabulous number. And, you know, seeing that, you know, the total food budgets of schools is at 30, and this is just public schools, it is at $32 million. You know, obviously the opportunity for our local farm economy is just enormous.
Well, there's the question of cost, I guess, in the past. Is this perceived as more expensive to buy local? And is it more expensive, really?
It can be more expensive, but it isn't always. And when you think about a farm-to-school program and think smart about a farm-to-school program, we're always looking for the right fit. And there's certain products that are just more costly for farmers to grow locally, and they may not be the right fit. And then there's plenty of products that can really be quite competitive with the commodity stuff.
Do you think that kids, like when they're, you know, younger, if we introduce them to more natural foods, you know, that come from close by where they live, is this a good time to catch them and to help them to cultivate a sense of wanting to eat healthy?
There's just no question about it. The CDC, the Centers for Disease Control, has stated that farm-to-school programs and catching kids when they're young is really the key for health outcomes, for sure. Kids, it takes 5 or 6 times of trying a new food before we tend to develop a taste for it. And catching kids when they're young and exposing them to lots of the different flavors of healthy food is really key.
Have you gotten any sense of what the kids are saying? Are they noticing this new stuff popping up in their lunches?
Well, I know the program that we do here in Madison, they notice. We work pretty hard to make sure they do notice. And supporting the food with educational programming and enthusiasm from teachers and administrators at the schools to really make it fun and exciting to try new things, that's really a big part of it. But that the old adage that kids won't eat healthy food, I think that we all are past that. When it's presented in a pleasing and delicious way, kids definitely will eat the food.
All right. Well, Miriam, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you.
Miriam Gruens is the executive director of REAP Food Group. Conservationist, author, and activist Terry Tempest Williams is in Madison today. She'll be giving a talk at the Nelson Institute at Mills Concert Hall this evening at 7 o'clock on the UW-Madison campus.
An author, she's also known for her work as an environmental activist. We spoke with her earlier today about finding people's voices and bearing witness to the events and places that shape our time. Her latest book is a memoir called When Women Were Birds.
Terry, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you, Veronica. It's wonderful to be back in Madison.
Well, I want to start off with your latest book. It's called When Women Were Birds. Can you give us a taste of that?
Yes, I'm going to read toward the end. I should say it's a book about voice. My voice rises again and again in beauty within the wonder and awe of the spectacle, an exaltation of larks, the murmuration of starlings, a murder of crows, a parliament of owls. And then in the privacy of truth, there is still the repeating courage of one hermit thrush hidden in the woods, singing between intervals of thunder. It is not in sorrow that I am moved to speak or act, but in the beauty of what remains. An albatross on Midway Atoll, dead and decomposing, is now a nest of feathers harboring plastic from the Pacific gyre of garbage swirling in the sea. We can kneel in horror and beg forgiveness, or we can turn away. But the albatross crying overhead, buoyed up by the breeze, is suspended in air by her vast bridge of wings. She is the one who beckons us to respond. How shall I live? I want to feel both the beauty and the pain of the age we are living in. I want to survive my life without becoming numb. I want to speak and comprehend words of wounding without having these words become the landscape where I dwell. I want to possess a light touch that can elevate darkness to the realm of stars. What is time, sacred time, but the acceleration of consciousness? There are so many ways to change the sentences we have been given. We cannot do it alone. We do it alone. How shall we live? Once upon a time, when women were birds, there was the simple understanding that to sing at dawn and to sing at dusk was to heal the world through joy. The birds still remember what we have forgotten, that the world is meant to be celebrated.
Oh, that is beautiful. Thank you so much for sharing that with us. And I was struck by a part of that passage. We talk about having to have the courage both to use your voice and not to look away. And I know that's something that you've tried to do very hard in your own life, that the twin struggles to locate your voice, to use it, and to refuse to look away, even when there is suffering and pain going on. And I wonder if you could talk about how those two ideas have played out in your own life.
That's such an astute comment. To not avert our gaze, I think that is crucial to being a fully present human being, to be able to accept the contradictions of joy and sorrow in the world we live in. You know, I think of my mother. She, when Brooke and I were married, she gave me a handkerchief. And, you know, I never thought about why. And I think that when we choose to marry ourselves to a person, a place, or an idea, then we also choose to embrace both the joy and sorrow of what it means to be human. And I think that's what my mother was doing with that seemingly simple gesture.
And you have engaged in something I've heard you call ground truthing. And I guess it's another thread of that. It's bearing witness to some of the flashpoints of pain in the world. You went to Rwanda after the genocide. You were in the Gulf of Mexico after the oil spill. Why is it important to you to go to these places and absorb their pain and what's actually happening on the ground for yourself?
You know, I have to say, they weren't choices. They were opportunities. They were invitations. And in the case of Rwanda, Lily Yeh, an artist I admire greatly out of Philadelphia who started the Village of Arts and Humanities, asked me to accompany her to Rwanda to be her scribe in creating with genocide survivors in the region of Gisenyi near the Congo to help create a genocide memorial. I said no. She kept staring at me. And I think in that moment, on some very deep level, I knew that my soul and my own spiritual growth depended on that. And I heard myself saying yes. In terms of the Gulf, that was something that came as an assignment from Orion magazine. I was terrified. But I realized, again, the pelicans that I have come to love at Great Salt Lake in my own home ground were being affected in the Gulf, and I wanted to see that for myself. I think so much of our world now is virtual, and the power of direct experience, of bearing witness, of coming back with a story firsthand matters, and it matters to me as a writer and as an engaged citizen.
And it sounds like what you did in these places is similar to your philosophy. You know, you've talked a lot about how women and the land and health, that it's all of a piece. And so when you go to these places, it sounds like you're not just checking in on something separate. You're checking in on, you know, what's part of all of us as a unified whole. How has that been important to you to think about and to live that philosophy of women and activism and health being so interconnected?
You know, you talk about ground truthing. I don't think we're told the truth. And I will never forget going to the Gulf of Mexico during the oil spill. It was day 100. I didn't realize that until we got there. And I noticed on the front page of the New York Times above the fold right-hand corner, it said 80% of the oil in the Gulf is gone. Nature is absorbing it, no problem. Well, we went out with a barefoot pilot 800 feet above the Macondo Well, and it was anything but gone. For as far as you could see, as wide as you could see, all you could see was oil. And I have not trusted the New York Times or any news agency since, very few. So that's ground truthing to me, to see it with your own eyes, to see the connective tissue, to talk to mothers in Mobile, Alabama, and their instinct was that the Corexit, the dispersant, was harming their children. They were told no. They hired their own chemist. The chemist tested the water. It blew up. You know, those are the stories you don't hear. In Rwanda, we are told that the genocide occurred in the spring of 1994, that in 100 days, 1 million Tutsis were murdered by hand by neighbors, by extremist Hutus. What we aren't told is that that genocide continued far beyond 1994. I first went in 2005, and there were still cars burning, a violence that remained that we turned our backs on. Those are the things that I think require ground truthing. And those are the writers that I pay attention to who are in direct experience speaking from witness.
And what do you do with that knowledge? You're there. Maybe it doesn't jive with what you've seen in the New York Times or you've heard about elsewhere. And you're one voice. What can one voice do?
All I do is listen. And then I try and tell a story that bypasses rhetoric and pierces the heart. You know, I remember when the Gulf War was beginning in 2002, and there was a demonstration, a manifestation in Firenze, in Florence, and I was participating. There were 1 million people in the streets of Florence. We were moving like water. And being cynical as an American, I turned to the young woman next to me from Rome, and I said, do you really think this is going to make any difference? Because in my heart, I thought George Bush is going to go to war. Cheney's going to go to war. What does this matter? And she turned to me and she said, it makes a difference to me. And I've never forgotten that. Change begins one heart at a time. Again, engagement, direct experience, bearing witness.
Well, in Wisconsin here at the moment, we're struggling with a lot of questions about iron mining, about frac sand mining. And as we move through environmental issues like these that have been very divisive and difficult and ongoing, you know, involving natural resources, what advice would you give people and communities and governments to think about?
You know, this is an issue before so many of us. We're experiencing it in Utah and Wyoming. Recently, I was with Tim DeChristopher, who's, you know, spent 2 years in jail, as an act of civil disobedience, of protesting illegal leases in Utah. We met with four very brave people who committed civil disobedience in Michigan because of the oil spill there. They are headed toward trial. They could spend many years in jail. You say, what can we do as citizens? I think more and more citizens who see that the quality of our water is at stake because of tar sands development, because of oil and gas, because of fracking, are standing up, rising up, and saying, no, no more. And I think there has to be more of us together in communities that do that. Democracy insists on engagement, and numbers matter. Right now, we are seeing a heroic few. I hope that we can see a brave many.
And let's see if we can end where we began, about the power of the voices. We heard about all those birds' voices in the beginning. And I know you think about finding your voice. Do you feel that as an activist and a woman and a citizen in democracy now, have you found your voice?
I think it's an ongoing struggle. I struggle to find my voice every day, even speaking with you, to try and tell the truth, to speak from a place of meaning and integrity. You know, tonight I'm speaking at the Nelson Center at the University of Wisconsin, and it's named after Gaylord Nelson, a man I greatly admire who I had the privilege of meeting at the Wilderness Society. You know, he was a voice in the wilderness talking about population, and that is a subject we still can't speak about. So I'm mindful of the power of his one voice. A senator from Wisconsin who started Earth Day. And that voice continues through all of us. And so I think it's about realizing the world is changing, that we participate in that change, and it behooves us to pay attention.
Well, Terry, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much, Veronica. Thank you for your voice.
That was Terry Tempest Williams. She's a conservationist, author, and activist, and She's in Wisconsin. She's going to be speaking tonight in Madison at 7 o'clock at the Mills Concert Hall on the UW campus. Her latest book is When Women Were Birds.
Thank you to everyone who contributed during our fall membership drive.
Oh, yeah.
More than 6,300 listeners pledged, including 1,600 sustaining pledges and 1,300 new members. You donated over $811,000 to fund the Wisconsin Public Radio programs that you depend on. Thank you so much for that.
Definitely. Thank you. Hey, here's another way you can help us on Central Time in particular. We are always looking for questions for our Curious Wisconsin segment. Is there something you wonder, why is it that way here in the state? Or our Hidden Wisconsin segment? Do you do a job that makes you an unsung hero of sorts that you'd like to talk about? Either way, tell us about it at 855-683-5422. That's 855-683-5422. And leave us a message there.
Coming up tomorrow on Central Time, we'll hear about the factors that go into whether or not remarried couples succeed or fail in their new families.
And we'll speak with the founding editor of Jezebel.com about what it means to run a news site dedicated to lady things.
And then we'll discuss what the cowbell means to Wisconsin culture.
That and the news of the day, all coming up tomorrow on Central Time.
Coming up after the news, we'll talk to the owner of a new Wisconsin business that's getting a lot of attention, the Snuggle House. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Stick around. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.